You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Monday, August 12th, 2013. My name is Matt Binder.
And I'm Michael Brooks. And this is the Majority Report.
It is Matt and Mike Monday on the Majority Report. And we are broadcasting to you live from the literal but not metaphorical shadow of the New York Times building.
In the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. We have a great show for you today, folks. Professor Vijay Prashad, one of the world's leading radical scholars, will be on to talk with us about his new book, The Poorer Nations, and about the revelations that Bradley Manning gave us about U.S. conduct towards the developing world. And
also joining us will be Rainey Reitman, who is the activism director over at the EFF, to discuss this past Friday Obama's NSA press conference he held. We're going to go through Obama's four commitments and on this massive surveillance, and what's missing from these four commitments.
And somehow the most important revelation of last week, the Reuters report that the NSA is sharing secretly gathered intelligence with the DEA and IRS, somehow wasn't mentioned at the president's press conference. Sort of a fail there, guys. Making everything else moot. And other great news, Stop and Frisk has been struck down by a court judge here in New York. That is a really big deal and great news. Attorney General Eric Holder getting rid of federal mandatory minimums for nonviolent drug offenses. It's, well, a breath of justice is in the air. An air of justice is in the air. Good news. What else do we have today, Matt?
We have the story of a family who fled the U.S., just decided to jump on a ship and head out wherever God takes them.
God, keyword there,
because
folks.
They hate homosexuality and abortion and taxes. And we'll find out what happened to this family. we've also got a disgusting story about hateful flyers against the disabled being passed around in Portland. And a congressman who saw some physically fit people using food stamps? What?
Excuse me?
What?
And John McCain with some interesting thoughts on Edward Snowden supporters. A little different than Michael Hayden's, to be fair. Coming at it from a little bit of a different perspective. But all of that and more, folks. We have a great, great show for you today. We're going to be back in about 30 seconds with Professor Vijay Prashad, and then right after that, Rainey Reitman from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Matt and Mike Monday on the Majority Report.
We celebrate like I finished probation, boy. Not can with no chaser, boy. From the mouth, I can spit out a razor, boy. Open up your facial like your boy in his prime. Eat food, dinner time, junior gong, past beginners. Handle business, black velvet, sippers, females never bid us farewell, they with us. Cause we arrive on a scene just like a high beam, nah, I mean. Don't let us have to make the nine scream, nah, I mean. At your racial police, ain't regime, nah, I mean. Spiritual well like an Elohim, nah, I mean. In a casino or yeah, wherever I'm seen, my brothers and sisters are never forgotten, I mean. Don't want to hear another soldier drop, nah, I mean. Another dope addict is shot with the morphine, and feds are indicting my block, nah, I mean. They're wearing reds from their shoes to their top, nah, I mean. I'm wishing that all the violence would stop, nah, I mean.
Really like this song, I'm sorry, nah, I mean. And some boys soft like ice cream, nah, I mean. From my boy, make the feds intervene, nah, I mean.
We send a war go take him shot in a me. Parabellum them a itch up in a spleen a me. In a Queen's gunman reign supreme na me. Kingstonians are real blood fiends na me. The world is a big crime scene na me.
Yo, yo, Mr. President.
Yo, Mr. President.
What you doing for my residence?
What you doing for my residence?
Yo, Mr. Minister.
Mr. Minister.
Why you being sinister? Hey.
Yo, yo, Mr. President.
Yo, yo, Mr. President.
What you doing for my residence?
What you doing with my residence?
Yo, Mr. Minister.
Mr. Minister.
Why you being sinister?
Someone in a real buffalo in a Rastafari regime. Bush bungalow where me dwell with my queen. Trash to the bone in a camouflage green. Look for them where can't go the places we've been. Look for them where can't see the sights where we've seen. That's why them face all a twist up and a lean on me. They better mind we kick it off clean on me. Man a gangster just like Yamdeen. That mean them can't.
We are back on the Majority Report. My name is Matt Binder.
And I am Michael Brooks. And joining us now is Professor Vijay Prashad. He is the Edward Said Chair at American University in Beirut. Hi, Professor Prashad. How are you?
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's a great pleasure to have you on. And I wanted to start off by speaking with you about, you know, we've been covering the Bradley Manning trial extensively on this show. He hasn't been sentenced yet, but obviously he faces a very draconian punishment in addition to what he's already gone through. And I wanted to focus on an aspect of his disclosures, which I don't think always get enough attention, which is really the kind of systemic interference of U.S. foreign policy in developing countries, if I could put it like that. So as an example would be the U.S. Pressuring the Haitian government to not raise that country's minimum wage. And I'm just wondering if you could run down other revelations like that Bradley Manning released and kind of put that in context for us.
Well, you know, it's very interesting. There were, I don't know, 700,000 State Department cables released, and two contradictory views were put forward by the U.S. government on that release. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, they said this is very bad for U.S. Diplomacy, this is going to put people at great risk, etc. On the other hand, they said nothing in here is what is going to be a surprise to anybody. In other words, they heightened the fear-mongering around the release itself to put pressure on people like Manning, whistleblowers like Manning. And on the other hand, they say, well, there's nothing in here, so you needn't bother to read it. You know, it's a very clever strategy of both amping up the fear-mongering around whistleblowing and to deflate expectations of what one might find in the release. Well, if you actually went and looked through the release, you would find a series of very important revelations. The most significant revelation for our present moment is, you know, it showed how the United States government was colluding with governments around the world, including in Yemen and Pakistan, with the drone program. So you have Yemeni leaders saying to the American government, you know, you go ahead and continue with the drone attacks just as long as you leave enough space for us to claim responsibility because, you know, our sovereignty is on the line, etc. So the drone program is very, I think that there's a lot that can be learned from how the drone program operated in WikiLeaks. The second set of revelations that got almost no, zero coverage was the one you have mentioned, which is the economic pressures. And let's just take the example you gave. You gave the example of Haiti. It's very interesting that in the Haitian releases, which I think the Nation magazine may have been the one to concentrate on those, in the Haitian release, you know, these companies, such as I think, you know, mainly companies that manufacture undergarments.
Yeah, like,
you know,
Fruit
like
of the Loom.
Fruit on the Loom or yeah. Something. I can't remember exactly.
I think it was Fruit of the Loom, yeah.
Fruit of the Loom. And maybe the other one, the women's undergarments. It's with an H. I can't remember the name.
I can't help you on
at
that
any
one.
Rate.
No.
Yeah, at any rate, these firms had approached the U.S. embassy in Port-au-Prince, and the U.S. ambassador and his team reached out to René Préval, the head of government, and asked him to use his authority to put pressure to minimum, to tamp down wages, to something, some abysmal level of wages to begin with. So the second set of revelations, if the first set was about political matters and really, quite scandalous collusion with foreign governments, the second was the use of the U.S. diplomatic corps for corporate ends. Now, it should be said that somebody can turn around and say, well, why else do you have a diplomatic corps? I mean, right. Diplomatic corps around the world use their influence as best as they can, to get a good deal for their firms. There's a big difference between trying to get a good deal for your firm and involving yourself in domestic labor management and economic policy. In other words, the question of minimum wage for a sovereign country like Haiti. So I think there was almost zero coverage of what had happened. And if there was coverage, it misconstrued the coverage. So the coverage wasn't the U.S. government intervened. Well, all governments intervene, all diplomatic corps intervene. The question is here, it wasn't to get, fruit of the loom, to get them a meeting with somebody in the Haitian, labor ministry. It was to actually use the offices of the U.S. government to pressure the Haitian government on how they should handle their minimum wage, regime.
Exactly.
I think that's a very disturbing, issue.
No, and I think that that's really crucial, and I really appreciate how you highlighted that, because I think that a lot of us, even among the kind of broader general public, there is some familiarity with trade regimes and how trade regimes have been written. I think even at a very basic level, there's a sense that trade agreements, they're not strictly speaking just, these neutral regimes of trade and tariffs. They've been written to benefit certain sectors of the U.S. economy. They've been written to benefit, primarily corporate special interests. That's pretty obvious and pretty clear. But even that process, even if you object to it, that's a bureaucratic process. That's look, we sign these agreements. Maybe we don't like how these agreements are made. There's problems with lobbying and all the rest. And that's valid to critique and object to. But it almost shields this more kind of ruthless arm that is still exercised in the Haiti example. And I think that that's interesting. How widespread in U.S. foreign policy and in developed world foreign policy is that kind of iron fist behind the bureaucracy of the trade agreements? I guess what I'm saying is you might hear somebody say, hey, that's not good for Haiti's development strategy. And if they raise their wages, they might not meet their obligations under some bilateral trade agreement or, some World Bank loan. And that's a problem. But this is the next step, like you're saying. This is literally the direct application of U.S. foreign policy as a tool of a very narrow economic interest.
Yes. I mean, this is not even, one can make the case, and I think it's a legitimate case to make, where a country goes to another country and says, we think that your, these tariffs that you have or these subsidies that you provide is not making it possible for our business, in general, to work with you effectively. In other words, there's a broad swath discussion about trade policy where the United States says, if you get rid of these subsidies, then all our businesses can come and do business in a much more, in a much more robust way.
Right.
But when you have the U.S. government essentially lobbying for one or two corporations, and really, it's almost as if there the ambassador is the lobbyist for Fruit on the Loom.
Right.
Fruit on the Loom. There's something crass about that in the first instance. There are a private entity, which I'm not even clear what its holdings are. It may be owned by a Swiss company at the end of the chain.
Right.
A private entity has the ambassador of the United States lobbying for them. There's something I think, very disturbing about that. And I think this, there should be a broader discussion whether the United States population would like to see its representatives work as emissaries of specific private corporations, rather than, you know, for the good of the, you know, U.S. business in general, which I think is the legitimate thing, you know, where you can talk about improving the climate for trade in general.
Right.
You know, so this distinction, I think, is quite an important distinction, because private companies should not assume that they have a special and privileged access, not only to their congressmen. You know, that is already a fight that's lost, I think, you know, where U.S. Congress people, elected representatives, have become essentially, emissaries of particular corporate. But now your diplomatic corps is also being reduced to that.
Right.
I think this is disturbing for domestic purposes. In other words, for U.S. citizens should be disturbed by this. This is very disturbing around the world, where one of the, let's just say it's a false sense of well-being, but one of the great ways in which many countries around the world hold their head up high is they say, well, our diplomatic corps is professional and is not touched by any of these kind of commercial things or whatever. You know, they're a highly professional group of people. In fact, I just heard an interview with the current Egyptian foreign minister, Nabil Fahmy, mm-hmm. where Fahmy was asked, you know, you used to be in the Egyptian diplomatic service during the Mubarak era, so aren't you compromised? And he said, let me tell you something. You know, when you join the diplomatic service in Egypt, you don't serve anybody. You just work professionally. And he says, we are a very professional corps of people.
Right.
That's the kind of thing I'm talking about. You know, when you have now tasked your ambassadors to operate on behalf of specific commercial interests, there's a real loss of face for them in front of the diplomatic corps around the world.
No, and I think that that's just such a vital, the economic parallel of the disclosures on things like drones or the collateral murder video. It's really important to highlight. So I want to get into, you have a new book out called The Poorer Nations, which came out, I believe, it was in February of this year. Is that correct?
Yes.
So, and yes. What you're doing is you're kind of doing a political history of the developing world, the third world, and you're kind of plotting where it's going and what its political project is. And I'm interested if you could kind of explain that. And I think you've said that it's kind of congealing with the BRIC countries, and maybe you could explain what the BRIC countries are and this strategy of growth with equity, I think you've called it, and why that might be an interesting answer to kind of Western-led neoliberalism, but not quite a credible alternative.
Right. So, you know, just to shorten this very, very dramatically, from the 1990s, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, with the collapse of really any effective countervailing force, the United States and its North Atlantic allies, mainly Western Europe, but we should also add Japan on the other end, began a real thrust on two different axes. One was political, where the assumption was that now the United States and its allies would determine the political future of the planet, you know, whether you use the UN Security Council or not. You know, you can bomb in Yugoslavia and create, the Dayton Accords. You can come in and bomb in Iraq, etc. You know, so there was a sense that the planet was there to be organized politically through the wishes of the United States and its European allies. Then the second was on the economic front. The assumption was that all other kinds of economic systems or challenges had been invalidated, and what was left standing was a sort of liberal capitalism, liberal democracy with free market capitalism.
The end of history.
That was the future. Yeah. Sorry?
No, I just said the end of history, that sort of thing.
Exactly.
Yeah,
it was Fukuyama's book, The End of History, was the sort of intellectual, you know, orientation of this triumphant emergence of Americanism, you know, not just the United States, but sort of Americanism. And in this, what it meant was the U.S. and its European allies attempted to push forward a certain trade regime, which they very successfully pushed forward during the Clinton years.
Yep.
You know, it included, rather than multilateral trading agreements, although there were those through the WTO, it included an increase in bilateral trading. And, you know, one so-called bilateral or trilateral was NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement of 1994. So what things like NAFTA and, you know, other bilateral deals, free trade agreements, etc., what they did was they essentially allowed the advantages of history to benefit, you know, those who had been its beneficiaries, as it were, to continue to benefit them. So for instance, I'll just give you one example. There was a new intellectual property law that went into place. And in previous eras, intellectual property was based on the process that you use to get to a product. If you use a different process, you're welcome to make the same product. Mm-hmm. In the 1990s, the new law was that the product was patented. What this meant was that in the United States, firms that had come up with new developments need no longer worry about producing them inside the country. You can outsource it anywhere in the world. But because of the new intellectual property regime, you're guaranteed a rent of that good that you're producing. This meant that in the United States, you started losing industrial jobs. It meant that there were low-wage jobs going to other countries. But it meant that American firms could continue to post very large profits. And that was the crucial process by which you get this triumphalism. At the same time, you get deindustrialization in America, and you get the rise of petty industry around the world. And, you know, this was assumed that it will happen forever. But of course, it doesn't happen forever, because where you start outsourcing your jobs to, those countries begin to emerge as powerhouses. And the BRICS emerge, one, concretely through the fact that there are now industries in some of these countries, like in China, for instance, which booms.
Just to be clear for the audience, the BRICS are Brazil, China, Russia, India, and I think South Africa might be informally part of that group now as well?
Yes, formally, in fact, from 2009, Brazil, Russia, China, India, South Africa.
Okay.
You know, these are countries that benefited greatly. At the same time, they felt hemmed in by the kind of political and economic Americanism of the 1990s. And it's that challenge that they have now, you know, to basically counter this suffocation, what they feel is a political suffocation. They created the BRICS project. And their emergence, I think, has brought us to some extent back toward the road of multilateralism, you know, where you don't have one country or one country and its allies determining the fate of the planet.
And but you also have some criticisms of the BRIC approach, because you think that I'm trying to summarize what I think you've said, that it's still limited and kind of hemmed in by a certain market vision that won't kind of, in the end of the day, address core structural inequities in BRIC countries, or if it's exported even as a model. So then there's this third example you're looking to, which are like the more radical governments in Bolivia, Venezuela, and then also this growth of social movements, which is interesting because you draw the parallel with the deindustrialization of the West. It seemed like through the 90s, as we were deindustrializing, we were kind of floating on this tech bubble economy and housing prices were going up and everything seemed fine. But of course, it's really not. The middle class and the working class are very hollowed out in the United States. So there's this kind of, is there a third parallel, a third track you're identifying of movements and kind of radical experiments in governance as well?
Oh, of course. I mean, the problem with the BRICS is that they, even though they're a challenge to the unipolar or single, you know, dominance by the U.S. and its allies, they follow the same kind of growth trajectory. You know, the idea is that to live in the world, the core, you know, thing that we must all follow is that growth rate must keep going up. And despite the fact that there may be inequalities despite the fact that there may be unemployment, etc. In other words, growth becomes the single-minded focus of political governance. This is a very disturbing trend, but it's what we have in these countries. Now, in Latin America, for a host of different reasons, a different kind of growth trajectory has been experimented with, where horizontal development, trying to fight against inequalities and trying to increase consumption rates of ordinary people is the premise of their growth. And I think this is very promising for us. It should be very promising for people in the United States. This idea has been developed that Latin America is ruled by dictators, that, it's authoritarian, etc. This is a smokescreen. It prevents people in the United States from looking closely to the closest geographical region where something different and interesting is happening. In the United States, the only way to continue to maintain levels of prosperity is to keep inflating asset bubbles.
Yes.
Whether it's going to be housing again, it may be, credit card debt, and these bubbles will be inflated by Chinese, Gulf Arab, other big sovereign funds with their credit. It's a very unhealthy situation. And recently I heard President Obama say, the second job of the Fed, you have one job is to create monetary policy, to create some confidence in money. But the second job, he said, it's remarkable that he said this, is for full employment. He said full employment is important.
Right.
You're never going to get full employment in the United States if the government continues to pursue a growth-led development model. There has to be a different way, and that is being modeled in Latin America.
And do you think, and connected to that, do you have optimism in the kind of constellation of social movements, like obviously we saw Occupy in America, but all across, and certainly Europe, in response to the kind of self-detonation through austerity, you do see these social movements. And then that's, I think it's an interesting parallel, because in a global sense, I'm seeing, you're drawing a distinction between some of the experiments and hope in Latin America and the improvement that the BRICS offer, but the fact that they don't fully offer a way out. And I think that there's a parallel between that and the kind of exhaustion maybe of social democratic models in Europe and even in the United, or democratic models in the United States, and the growth of these social movements generally.
No, you're right. But I'll just be a little much more crude than that,
yeah.
In a sense. I mean, one of the grave problems in the United States is the undertow of the two-party system.
Mm-hmm.
So at two ends of the spectrum, you have populist breakthroughs. On the one side, you get combination of people with not much wealth, but who had white-collar jobs, and then some blue-collar, upper-level blue-collar people entered the so-called Tea Party movement. In the early period, it's certainly a grassroots kind of effort. People who had been laid off from office parks, etc., who had their homes underwater, deep frustration, what's going on? Of course, that is going to get oversaturated with, racism, other things will come in. But basically, that was a protest movement which very quickly is going to be grabbed by the Republican Party. That's what I mean by the undertow of the two-party system. On the other hand, you have Occupy. Again, here, what is the class background? A lot of students of different classes struggling under student debt.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people who had been laid off from the promise of some kind of life. A lot of people frustrated, people who found themselves in trade unions and them being betrayed by the political parties. A lot of activity. But once again, the pressure on this, on the Occupy movement from the Democratic Party this side, saying, well, it's an election coming up and you have to fight against the right. Unless this undertow of the two-party system is somehow set aside, and genuine mass political movements are able to emerge that actually threaten the political order, which put them on notice genuinely, there's going to be no possibility in the United States of changing the course of its social democracy or its political economy. There will be no hope of of reviving, you know, 19th century social democracy, any kind of politics, unless this is gone. I mean, the tragedy is that the two mainstream parties share so very much in the way they manage the politics and the economy, but that small bandwidth of difference that they exaggerate, you know, around social issues allows them to capture the entirety of the political space. And I think unless that ends, there's very little hope for a new direction in the United States.
Well, thank you so much. On that note, Vijay Prashad, we're gonna end. I really, really appreciate your time. I recommend highly everybody look up Vijay Prashad's new book, The Poorer Nations, as well as his other work. There's also The Darker Nations, several other really, really important pieces, and you can see his writing a counterpunch among other outlets. Thank you so much, Vijay Prashad.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Take care. Okay, folks, we are going to have a quick break, and Matt is going to come back with an interview with Rainey Reitman from the Electronic Frontier Foundation on President Obama's press conference on the NSA disclosures. We'll be back in 30 seconds. Thanks for listening.
We are back on the Majority Report. My name is Matt Binder, and joining us now, we have Rainey Reitman of the EFF, or the Electronic Frontier Foundation. She's the activism director over there. Rainey, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's get right to this. On Friday, afternoon, President Obama held a press conference to discuss basically what is the growing concern, both in the public and in the press, of the NSA's massive surveillance program. And information continues to come out on this. New revelations continue to be published. And you put up a post on the EFF's website, EFF.org, that basically went through Obama's four commitments that he mentioned in this press conference to basically be more transparent and possibly reform the NSA's program so that the public feels more comfortable with it. Really quick, though, let's begin with what was your takeaway? What was your opinion on Obama's speech on the NSA surveillance programs on Friday?
Well, just, you know, without getting into the details, what Obama did was he stood up and he acknowledged that there is a lot of public discomfort with the leaks that have been made public about what the National Security Agency is doing. And even though he was promising that he was going to take steps to reform the programs and become more transparent, he did not at any point actually say, hey, we're going to be reducing the amount of spying that we're doing domestically, much less internationally, which is a whole other can of worms. But even as far as it goes for collecting, for example, the call records of Americans, he didn't make any specific promises of reducing the amount of data collection that's currently going on that collects information on everyday Americans who aren't suspected of any particular crime. So while it is disappointing that he didn't take this opportunity to say, yes, we are, in fact, definitely going to be reining in the surveillance so that we are collecting less information, he did at least acknowledge that people are uncomfortable with it and then make several very specific promises about what he was going to do to try to reform the programs and bring more transparency.
All right, so let's go right into those great segue. Let's go right into those promises that he somewhat made, I guess. But you pointed out that there's plenty missing in these four specific commitments. Let's get with right to number one. Obama will work with Congress to pursue appropriate reforms to Section 215 of the Patriot Act. Can you explain what that is and what Section 215 of the Patriot Act is?
Right, definitely. So the Patriot Act was passed very quickly after 9/11. It was a huge package of initiatives that would further empower the government to do a variety of things, including greater surveillance. Section 215 of the Patriot Act is known as the business records section. It allows the government to collect information that is tangible and relevant to an authorized investigation. The current court order that was signed by the FISA court, which allows for the collection of all of our phone records, all Verizon business phone records, was the order that was leaked, both now and going forward for 3-month periods. That is an order that is supposedly authorized under Section 215 of the Patriot Act. Now, the authors of the Patriot Act have actually come forward and said, you know, when we wrote the Patriot Act, we didn't think that anyone was going to use that particular section to try to drag in all of these records that don't, from our appearance, seem to be relevant to an authorized investigation. And there have been a number of bills introduced into Congress that attempt to address how Section 215 is getting broadly interpreted. So what Obama is saying is that he's going to be pursuing appropriate reforms to this section of the law. Now, I think what's important for people to understand is that there are a lot of people who are introducing pieces of legislation, and it's unclear just how effective those pieces of legislation are going to be in actually preventing this type of surveillance from taking place. It's a difficult issue. I think a strict interpretation of Section 215 would not allow for the current forms of surveillance, which makes it particularly troublesome that they think they even need to reform the law to stop it from happening. But the other thing that's really important to know is that there's many other laws that need to get reformed. It's not just Section 215.
What's interesting, too, is his vague usage of the term appropriate reforms. Like, there was no explanation as to what appropriate reforms he would even approach.
Absolutely. He didn't say, we're going to roll back Section 215 so that there are no more additional surveillance rights than there were previous to 9/11. He's not saying we're going to remove Section 215 authorities. And he didn't say, I'm going to ensure that Section 215 can't be used for mass surveillance. He didn't say any of those things. He just said this vague, oh, we're going to pursue appropriate reforms. We're going to work with Congress. So I don't know if we can put a lot of faith into that particular promise. I mean, I'm glad to hear that he's at least interested in working on those reforms and won't block them. But really, the devil's going to be in the details.
And you also point out how he also did not address in the Patriot Act, Section 702, which you mentioned is the statute that the government cites to support the broader surveillance, such as the content of communications.
Right. So many of the people who are particularly troubled by the leaks that have come out are often very troubled by the PRISM program, which was the big leak that came out that showcased how the government is working with various internet providers. The degree to which is pretty unclear still at this point, but among other things, that they're able to access content of internet communications as well as sort of even information like, you know, what websites you might be clicking on and internet traffic more generally.
Mm-hmm.
So while I think there's still particular questions that remain about how that program works, that program is authorized under a wholly different section of law, to the extent it is even authorized. And that is Section 702 of the FISA Amendments Act. No congressperson has put forward any legislation that would actually rein in that form of surveillance. And Obama did not stand up and say that he was going to do anything to reform or even add more transparency to that process.
Mm-hmm. So let's go to commitment number two, where Obama said that he will work with Congress to improve public confidence in the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court by creating a public advocate that can defend privacy in the court. Now, to me, this one sounds good, but you again, greatly point out that there's it shouldn't be so excited quite yet, even though it's a good start.
Right. Of the promises that Obama made, this is by far the most promising. So for the people out there who aren't familiar, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court was established back in the 70s, and it's supposed to provide oversight to when the government wants to get warrants to surveil suspected foreign intelligence agents outside of the United States. But as we have seen, largely as a result of these leaks, much of the surveillance that is getting signed off on by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court affects people here in the United States as well. So right now, this is a very secretive court. Their rulings are not made public. The briefs are not made public. The decisions are not made public. And you and I can't go and find out what's happening. And in fact, it's just the government and the judge. There's no opposing side. There's no adversarial person who's there trying to defend what the private citizen, what the public interest is. It's not really a traditional court at all. So this really has been an affront to the democratic principles of a fair court from the beginning. And the decision to actually put somebody in there to defend the other side, to say, hey, I'm representing the public's point of view, and I think this is overstepping boundaries, could be very, very powerful. However, we have our doubts about exactly how effective it's going to be. I think any public advocate in there is going to have at least the same sort of independence that a public defender would have, where they would and they'd ought to be able to get full access to all the materials that the government is presenting to defend their case. And I think we would need to know whether or not that public advocate is going to be available in every of the court proceedings. He used some really weird wiggle language when he discussed it. He said that they would have a defendant in appropriate cases. I certainly hope that means in all cases, because all cases are appropriate to have both sides of the argument argued.
Again, he uses that term, appropriate reforms, appropriate cases. I mean, it's so arbitrary. Who determines what's appropriate?
Right, exactly. I think that, unfortunately, many people saw this commitment and got very excited, but didn't drill down on exactly what it was he was promising to deliver.
Mm-hmm. So let's go to point three. Obama has directed the intelligence community to make public as much information about these programs as possible. Now, you just mentioned in discussing point two that, I mean, we have these secret courts, and then these secret courts are creating these secret laws. So, I mean, how are we to even know that this information that they make public is with these secret laws, how do we even know they're even letting us know about everything? I mean, I'm going to assume whatever's leaked so far is just what, oh, we'll make that stuff public, but they still don't know about whatever hasn't been leaked. So what's pulling our arm there to make that public?
Right. I think there are two really concerning things here. The first is that he said that as much information about these programs as possible. And the first question is, well, these programs, but what other programs has he not instructed the NSA to be more public about? Is it possible that they could interpret that directive as not forcing them to be as public as possible about all programs, but only certain programs? And then the other thing is the as possible. You know, as possible is really a subjective statement. I think that often the intelligence community argues that in order to maintain security, they've got to have extreme levels of secrecy to do their jobs and engage in their surveillance. We've heard them make that argument numerous times over the years. So there's this fear that they will say something like, well, we are being as public as possible, but in order to maintain national security, we really can't be very public at all. Obama specifically asked them to put up a website that would explain what they were and were not collecting. And so I guess we'll wait and see whether or not that website really has some substantive information in it. And he also asked the NSA to appoint a full-time civil liberties and privacy officer to be in charge of ensuring that the NSA doesn't overstep its boundaries with regards to civil liberties. I can't believe that they're just deciding to do that now in 2013, rather than years ago. But at least I suppose that's a good step in the right direction as well.
Here's also hoping that that website has another kids' corner to try to explain to kids that the NSA is a great organization that does great things.
Right, exactly.
Let's get to the fourth point here. Obama is creating a high-level group of outside experts to review our entire intelligence and communications technologies. What is this group?
That's a good question. So this group, he didn't say exactly what it was, but he did say that they were going to make an interim report in 60 days and a full report by the end of the year, which makes me think he's going to move quite quickly on putting this group together. He didn't say if it was a board, if it was an existing board. For example, he's got the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, which is a small, perhaps under-resourced, perhaps under-empowered board, which he has previously tasked with looking into the NSA. And then it's not clear, you know, is this board going to be independent? Will it have adequate subpoena power? Is it going to have staff time? Is it going to have resources? Is it going to even have any political clout so that they're taken seriously? So I'm not certain exactly what this board means and whether or not we can take this really as a positive step. Ultimately, if we really want to get to the bottom of the National Security Agency surveillance, we need Congress to engage in full investigations of what they're doing. Congress has a ton of power. Congress can subpoena individuals and force them to get on the record and respond to the public and answer questions. Outside group of experts is never going to have the same kind of power that a congressional committee has to investigate what the NSA is doing.
My co-producer, Michael, has a quick question.
Hi, Rennie. Sure. I just wanted to ask you, because I felt like another huge thing that you talk about in your piece that was not Obama didn't get a question about at the press conference, which in my mind shifts the whole terrain of this discussion from, you know, speculative abuses to very clearly actual abuses, was the Reuters report that some of these NSA intercepts are getting shared with the DEA and other federal agencies, which already kind of violates that sharp distinction between terrorism investigations and others. And I was just wondering if you could speak to that.
Well, so that wasn't something that Obama addressed during this particular press conference.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, to the extent that he's going to ensure that there aren't abuses of interagency sharing of information, that isn't something that he got up and made any commitments to. I think that's something that, if these are actually effective reforms, potentially the high-level group of outside experts that he's supposedly convening is going to be able to put forward certain recommendations around that. I do think that people are always concerned when agencies that didn't collect information are getting access to it or trying to get access to it. I think that's a major issue. I want to say that it's the point of collection, the collecting of information on Americans who aren't accused of any crime or even suspected of any crime, that is actually a point of concern in and of itself, regardless of which agencies do and do not get access to it. So there's a couple of different issues to kind of tease out there. But as far as whether or not Obama has responded to it, he just didn't bring it up, really.
He completely just ignored it.
Yeah, it seems really significant.
So just to get back to what was mentioned really quickly, just two more points I want to bring up from Obama's press conference. One was that he did acknowledge benefits of privacy technology like encryption. But I thought this was very interesting coming, I believe, less than a day after the encryption email service that Edward Snowden used, Lavabit, was shut down because of reasons that the owner of the company can't even talk about. I mean, could you speak to that?
Right. So there were two different email service provided that provided very private emails, Lavabit and then Silent Circle's email provider. Mm-hmm. Both of them shut down last week. And Lavabit said, we are not even allowed to discuss why it is we're getting shut down. We, you know, one presumes they're under some form of court order, which I would not speculate upon. And so their hands are tied, and they're literally shutting down their entire email service. So if you had email with them, your emails are inaccessible, as far as I know. You literally cannot get in there and get access to your old emails, rather than presumably responding to whatever government request they got. And Silent Circle's email provider saw the writing on the wall, they said, and followed suit about a day later, also shutting down the email accounts of all of the users.
Jeez.
As far as, you know, Obama's statement, I think it's interesting because up until now, the Obama administration, as well as higher-ups within Congress and within the intelligence community, have pushed very hard to get backdoor access to encrypted technologies. And they have said that they are, quote-unquote, going dark, that technology is getting very complex, and they're going dark. They're not going to be able to get into these technologies the way they'd like to, even when they have court approval. And so they need all technologies to build a backdoor for the government in case later down the road they might want to get into them. So it's very interesting for me to know that that's on his agenda as far as what he's attempting to achieve politically and legislatively in the coming years, and at the same time have him say something vaguely to the effect of, you know, technology itself could be a safeguard to prevent the government from surveilling you. I think that that's certainly not the only solution out there, but, you know, the Electronic Frontier Foundation has long said that you should be using technology to protect yourself, and that's technology like encryption. We have a free Firefox add-on called HTTPS Everywhere, which is one very small and very easy step you can take to protect yourself, but also encrypted chat, such as off-the-record chat, PGP on your email. There's a whole bunch of options out there. They're not all easy, but they're definitely worth investigating if you're concerned about your privacy.
Mm-hmm. So on that note, I just want to end it with what Obama had to say about Edward Snowden, which I thought was very interesting because he himself even admitted that Edward, while he wanted to give himself the props of having the agenda in mind of bringing this to the public's knowledge in terms of having a discussion about these things, he admitted that Edward Snowden pushed him towards bringing this stuff to the forefront much quicker. And he also made sure to say that Edward Snowden is no patriot regardless. I mean, the fact that that conference that he was having was straight up because of Edward Snowden, this conversation you and I are having are straight up because of Edward Snowden. I mean, to call him a patriot or not, fine, but just to downplay Edward Snowden's role, it was to me just ridiculous after he himself admitting what Edward Snowden's role in pushing him to talk about this was.
Yeah, that was a really interesting moment in the press conference. I was very confused when Obama said, you know, I myself have initiated a number of reforms and we were going to move ahead with them, even if Snowden hadn't jumped the gun by leaking this information. So my understanding is that, you know, Obama's previous promises around transparency reform had been really defensive comments after different leaks and, and different exposés. So there's no question that the reporting of Greenwald and Poitras of Edward Snowden's leaks has been incredibly instrumental to kickstarting this public debate. And certainly the information is going to be really important to getting people to understand exactly how much surveillance is happening to everybody. I mean, at the end of the day, there was nothing preventing Obama over the many years he's been president from just publishing information about how much surveillance is taking place so that people could find out about it and decide whether or not they are comfortable with it. He could still do that if he wanted to, instead of forcing us to find out about it in leaks, you know, with, you know, whistleblowers coming forward at huge personal risk to, you know, speak truth to power.
Yeah, I mean, so, Edward Snowden wasn't even the first NSA whistleblower. I mean, we had
saddened by that. Yeah.
I mean, and Edward Snowden wasn't even the first NSA whistleblower. Like we've had Thomas Drake on this show. I mean, if he had a real problem with this, he's had I mean, plenty of time to at least make some sort of statement about it before Edward Snowden, and he just didn't.
Yeah, he did not. Well, and you know, I would say that Edward Snowden also said that he didn't want this to be about him. He wanted it to be about the information that went out there. So I've often, you know, said let's focus on the facts, the information that was made public, and, you know, what the repercussions are for civil liberties and for the American people and for people all over the world, quite frankly, rather than getting down into the personal politics of, you know, is he a patriot or isn't he a patriot? The fact is, the American public needed to know this stuff, and now we do.
And what's also interesting, and a completely sort of not in this realm note, what they've done to try to apprehend him in terms of what happened to the President of Bolivia's plane in Europe. I mean, I think personally Edward Snowden is not the conversation, but definitely what the government's tried to do to him is certainly speaks to the NSA's mass surveillance campaign.
Yes, I think that there is a lot of concern about what's going to happen to Snowden next. I was particularly interested to see that during the press conference, Obama stated that he had enacted reforms for whistleblowers. And I'm not a whistleblower expert by any means, but my understanding of the whistleblower reforms that he put into place is that they were specific to government employees and would not cover contractors such as Snowden. Which leaves a lot of questions to be, you know, again, I'm not.
That's true, they wouldn't.
Certain of that.
That's absolutely
that's
true.
That's my understanding, yeah. Based on what I've read. And so, you know, I think we should take some of his promises with a bit of a grain of salt as far as his responses to Snowden goes.
Rainey Reitman, activism director at EFF. Folks, go to EFF.org. They're a great organization. They work on great things, everything from digital civil liberties to the NSA surveillance to even things
to
that affect
saving,
this show.
Saving
podcasts, yes, with podcast patent trolls. Rainey Reitman, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, folks, that was a lot. A lot of value packed into that hour. We're going to head to the better half of the show, but I think today we earned the right to at least do a little bit of a beg for at least one member.
Folks, become a member today at Majority.fm. Click the link, become a member. It's that simple.
It's so simple. It's
you'll
that
get
inexpensive. So easy.
You'll get all the bonus content that comes in the better half coming up next. You will support the whole show, not just the better half. You will support every part of the show to continue happening. Also, members also get a full video feed. As you know, we live stream the show on YouTube. But if you don't catch the live stream, just like if you don't catch the live broadcast of this show, you don't get the whole thing unless you're a paying member. However, with the YouTube live stream, we take those videos completely down after a day or two, unless you're a member. If you're a member, you have complete access to those YouTube videos, just like you have complete access to the full show since the beginning of the show began, 2010.
We're covering the slack for Sam. He'll be back tomorrow. But we gave you the radical worldview of what's happening today with Vijay Prashad. I think he's one of the most brilliant people writing and thinking about the world today. He got to go into detail. Then we had Rainey Reitman. This show is definitely worth supporting, is all I'm saying. And even if you don't become a member, you can support us. What is the other thing? The coffee.
JustCoffee.coop.
That's another great way to support the show.
Buy your stuff through our Amazon link. It's on the homepage in the left sidebar.
You can buy DJ's book, Poorer Nations, through our Amazon link.
Just click that link. Bookmark it. Use it to buy all of your stuff.
Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube.
Yes. And follow us on all those channels. Subscribe to us.
All of that. All right.
That's our free show today.
We'll see you in the better half.
Sit in a blue pen.